Hello and welcome to Armenian News Network GRUNK Week in Review. I'm Alan Zamanian, and together with Aspet Petrosyan, this week we're going to talk about the following major topics: President Sarkisyan's interview, legislation to criminalize defamation of government officials, appointment of acting governors and mayors during martial law, and finally, the opposition protests on February 20th.
And to talk about these issues, we have with us Aspet Kochigyan, who is an Associate Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the American University of Armenia; Marine Manucharyan, President of the Civic Forum NGO. Her areas of focus include Artsakh, the Armenian Armed Forces, and national security and foreign policy; and Emil Sanamyan, a Senior Research Fellow at USC's Institute of Armenian Studies, specializing in politics in the Caucasus with a special focus on Azerbaijan. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello, Aspet.
Hi, Aspet and Alan.
Earlier this week, former President Serge Sarkisyan gave a lengthy interview to Arm News. It was aired in two 90-minute segments covering events from the previous 3 years. A number of major points were made, ranging from details around the events of April-May 2018, criticism of Nikol Pashinyan's handling of the Karabakh conflict negotiations and the war, as well as post-war developments in Armenia. Marine, what were some of the key points that you found noteworthy?
Well, first of all, the interview itself was very, very important, although a bit probably too late, though. I found a lot of details that I was already assuming and following the 4 or 5 years period since 2016. And the important part aspects for me were the fact that Shushi was not taken over militarily, but was technically given through treason or something, that the negotiation, that if there is an investigation in place, we will discover the details. The second important part from the interview I took was that President Sarkisyan made a somewhat detailed analysis of the ongoing 44-day war, and he pointed out the mistakes that most of us could actually already guess following the processes, but he pointed to some very important aspects as well, including the chances to stop the war and save lives and also territories, and why not leave Armenia and on a better terms of negotiations. And also the third, probably I would mention the third one, is that he's not going to return to big politics, but rather to be a help and assistance to anyone who would succeed bringing down this regime.
Aspet Kochigyan, how about you? What caught your attention?
Marine mentioned already in terms of some of the issues mentioned, in terms of some of the highlights. It was also interesting to talk about the retrospectively about the transfer of power back in 2018 and some of his perspectives about the negotiations with Azerbaijan, including specifically Kazan document, as well as I said, the transfer of power. I think one of the things that resonated a lot with people were some people actually, and reactions to that interview that came up a lot, is the issue of why couldn't or why didn't Karen Karapetyan be the prime minister instead of handing power over. Some people even were criticizing President Sarkisyan that he actually basically gave power to Nikol it's always easy in hindsight 2022 to analyze and to adjust the logic or the reasons why one would do something. But I think at the time there were clear signs of some friction or within the Republican Party. In any event, a discussion for another time. But overall, I think this is following what former President Kocharyan spoke, recently as well, giving an interview. I think that these are all elements that is self-assessment, assigning blame, whatever you want to call it, but post-war realignment of not only the political forces, the juxtaposition of the opposition versus the current government, but also trying to retrospectively, to look at how we got where we are now. So I think more and more of these would be interesting to follow and to also situate them in the larger context of how, if at all, narratives change between the time, let's say, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, and now, and 4 years from now.
Emil, your thoughts?
Aspet and Marine already covered some of the reactions. Basically, I would divide the interview in two parts. The bigger part is sort of criticism of what he termed the capitulator, the capitulant, the current prime minister who surrendered Artsakh, and that was the larger part of the interview. And the smaller, or maybe sizable part of the interview was him, Serge Sarkisyan, justifying himself his own actions.
Right.
And I did think that his argument, his claim that he didn't surrender power to Pashinyan but surrendered it to Karapetyan was just, not based in actual events. Clearly, in his resignation statement, he made no mention of Karen Karapetyan, but he did mention Nikol Pashinyan. Clearly, his political party, on his instructions, voted Nikol Pashinyan into power. And, if we think that, yes, Karin Karapetyan was not up for a fight himself in terms of getting elected as prime minister, it was clear that he also surrendered. It was still upon Serge Sargsyan to confirm Nikol Pashinyan's nomination. So his party's votes were crucial in confirming that nomination. Of course, not just his, also Tsarukyan's and Dashnak's Dashnak parties. All of these people brought Nikol Pashinyan to power, of course, under public pressure, of course, under a sense that Nikol Pashinyan was coming to represent the aspirations of the sizable portion of the Armenian people. And subsequent months, of course, confirmed some of those expectations and disproved some of the other expectations. And we've been discussing that a lot. As far as the discussion of the Karabakh peace process, yes, clearly what Armenia could have accomplished through a compromised agreement under Serge Sargsyan would have been a much better deal than what ended up being, with all the deaths and destruction that were also resulting from the war. And it was actually a better deal than what Terpetrasyan wanted to have in 1997. But of course, there was opposition to it, and it wasn't clear that Serge Sargsyan was ready to push that deal through. And his claim that the reason he was staying in power was to make peace, I mean, I don't think it's based in reality. I mean, he had those 2 years to do it.
I also didn't buy that very much.
Yeah, I could have done it and basically surrendered power to somebody else, like Nikol Pashinyan anyway. So most of his justifications of his own policies I did not buy. However, the insights into the war and into criticism of the current government, I mean, criticism is always easier than self-criticism, criticism of your political opponents. So that point, especially about Armenia firing Iskander missiles into Shushi, was something that was a claim that was already made, but mm-hmm. Now it's being made by an ex-president who obviously has much better access to the military. And it told me how Nikol Pashinyan can go from passive to aggressive very quickly, from sort of latent reactions to really crazy reactions very quickly. And it seemed that was what was happening around Shushi. I don't think there was a conscious decision to surrender Shushi, but it was a clear apathy and clear inaction by the government that made it possible for Shushi to be captured by a relatively small Azerbaijani force.
Yeah, it was a completely mishandled situation.
Yes, but then after it happened, he sort of snapped and tried to do whatever was possible to do, and like sent all these young soldiers to die to try to recapture Shushi, and threw the Iskander missiles into Shushi, which might have actually destroyed one of the two Armenian churches there. That mm-hmm. It's not clear if that was a result of that attack or not, but I mean, they were destroyed around that same time. And the Azeri forces that came in there, I don't think they had the capacity to blow them up that quickly after the capture. So all of the combination of those decisions, from inaction to crazy actions and really detrimental actions, was the hallmark of the Armenian government's conduct of this war.
Yeah. Marina, what did you make of the whole narrative around Karin Karapetyan?
I think I have a bit more of a probably inner information on that matter. I think it's the fact that he did want to hand it over to Karapetyan is, for me, is non-negotiable. I do know that. But right. Another thing is that maybe they did not have a chance to be well prepared for the, next scenario or next steps due to the momentum and the wave of the public support that Nikol Pashinyan gained during that few days, let's say. I know that Karen Karapetyan did back up on the very last moment. I know that even in the speech, there was written that Karen and Nikol were right and I was wrong, so Karen asked to remove his name. The entire thing, I think, says Sargsyan was justifying himself. He was trying to say that the narrative that Nikol people are pushing, that not probably Nikol people, but let's say the opposition of Serge Sargsyan is pushing, that Nikol was entirely his project and he was brought up for this sort of events happening in 2020. So I think he was mostly justifying that. He was trying to say that this is not my project, even though if you look into his steps, one might think that it was brought up, created to work out this plan for the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. I want to make some remark regarding Shushi. Again, people that were there and some information and evidence coming in shows that it's very much connected to the document of November 9. And I believe that Shushi Shushi was the deal maker. So it would be no deal unless Shushi was handed over. So for me, it's very clear that that town is not possible to militarily take over unless there's like five times more forces there. And if you look at it logically, only one road through the cliffs was open to Shushi. The rest was controlled by the Armenian armed forces. So you cannot actually take over the ninth floor unless you take over fifth floor, you know? So it's like,
right.
It's really, even people fighting there, they found it very awkward because they were sure that they cleaned the city. And at some point they were ordered to move from their positions. So a lot of evidence like this. And I think if there is ever an investigation in place, it will be clear. However, everyone who's been there and everyone who I've personally spoken to, even on the day 6th and 7th of November, I was in touch with these people, and including pretty high level, you know, military. They were saying that Shushi was not taken over militarily, was not captured, in other words.
Also, it was quite interesting for me, his explicit intention not to run for office, not to seek office. And I think to a large extent, again, from previous statements and interviews I've conducted with people close to his administration at the time, it seems that Qarabağ, the issue of Artsakh, has always been, to some extent, you know, one of the main reasons why, especially Serge Sargsyan in this context, was interested in staying in power. In a way, it concurs what he was saying in terms of leaving. And to a large extent, the 2016 short war, comparatively speaking, was a turning point where he actually was not planning on running for prime minister or staying in power, but that changed his mind. And that's also one of the reasons why he ended up accepting or deciding to stay as prime minister. Now, the question is, at least in his mind or in the mind of many people, the issue of Artsakh, the issue of the conflict is somehow, I wouldn't call it resolved, but settled, let's call it. He doesn't see any reason for him to stay in a decision-making process. Although, as he also mentioned, that he is going to continue being the leader of the Republican Party, which is in itself is another interesting phenomenon, as there is a generational change or lack of generational change in all the political parties, classic political parties. And how would that be viewed by the party frontbenchers, the more younger leadership in the party? Something to look forward to.
Asped, there's an issue of succession, which I think the leadership usually doesn't seem to be taking care of very well. Unless Karen Garabedian was meant to be the successor to Serge Sargsyan in the Republican Party, etc., even though he was not part of the RPA, and it was a completely unexpected thing that Karen Garabedian suddenly decided that he was not going to fight for the prime ministership, I think that there's an issue by all of our governments in not planning the next leadership that's going to take over. Otherwise, you know, when your term ends, for example, in the United States, the president doesn't say, I need a third term to finish something. The next president will take over and continue from there, right?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And even though there have been some cosmetic changes in some of the leaderships of the, for instance, the ARF, the Dashnaks, for instance, they have a younger leader and so on, but a lot of people wouldn't buy that. One thing I have to mention, that Karen Garabedian, up until 2017 December, he was a non-party member of the RPA, Republican Party. It was at the party congress that actually he did join the RPA. And that might have been also one of the factors why, probably, if he hadn't joined, again, hypothetical is easy to talk, right? It would have been interesting that had he not joined, would he have been an acceptable alternative to be interim prime minister, at least in the April, May 2018 and onwards until December, for instance. And there are a lot of people, actually, at the time when I had interviewed many people there, like there were even people in the RPA itself, members of RPA, who would have been acceptable to be part of an interim government, including but not limited to the former Minister of Justice, David Harutyunyan, and others. But absolutely, generational change is a problem. You see this in the Armenian National Congress, you see this in the Republican Party, you see this in Barkavaj, and so on and so forth. Even the newer parties, you know, there is no generational change. In a way, unfortunately, in a way, the only generational change that happened was when a completely different popular movement came to power. And that is the generational change that we witness. And I know I'm not talking about age, but also a whole a generation in terms of mentality, a generation in terms of post-war, and so on and so forth. It is a challenge that after 30 years, we keep saying, oh, it's Armenia, still a new country, it has to go through that. You know, how much more mileage can you get out of this new country phenomenon?
Mm-hmm.
It's across the board problem, right? I mean, ARF is really an exception that it actually has a turnover of leadership in terms of, you know, representing.
It's the most mature organization. It's the most mature party.
Yeah. Still, even with you know, some of the ARF affiliated organizations, you kind of have leadership for life or for a really extended period of time. And of course, that's the case with the Republican Party, all of the other entities that, even the smaller parties that never came to power, they still have, they were established, say, in the early 90s, you know, like small groups like Constitutional Rights Union. They only had the change of leadership in the case of death of the leader. And same thing with the Republican Party. So that's the lack of this internal democracy within the groups that are essentially contending for leadership in Armenia accentuates a lack of compromise solutions. And the biggest problem that Armenia is facing right now is that even with the constitutionally allowed change of government right now, where the majority of parliament decides who is prime minister and could basically replace the prime minister, that's not happening because of this tradition of authoritarian leadership within political groups.
Which goes into the heart of the democratization, right? I think, I mean, there is a lot of scholarship out there that, you know, argue that democratic political parties are crucial in establishing democratic culture within the political life in the country.
Yeah, it's an institutional immaturity. Marine?
Yeah, after all we've been through past 6 months, the word democracy brings me goosebumps. Actually, I disagree a little bit regarding the generation change when it comes to the Republican Party, because I think if you, off top of your head, bring together like a team of 10 who can run the country, probably all of them or most of them would be from the Republican Party, prepared young people. I mean, the same Ashotian and Arpine. I don't want to go into, you know.
It's true. They have the longest experience.
They had the longest experience and they are the vibrant, dynamic, young. So if one would want to get a successor, I think it would be easy for the Republican Party first or second. The problem is here, the overall lies and myths and I don't know, the disgusting atmosphere of political arena in general in this country, because we are literally not seeing the actual subjects, people, or ideas, but we're seeing mostly the hatred that is in the field. And I will not be wrong to be not to be very shy, you know, shy to say that this is with the new government that is in the place. So the ongoing hatred that is being generated towards anyone that speaks against Nikol Pashinyan and sort of a rule of games that he established. And that's now we live in that situation and it's really hard to look forward and move forward. So that's why whatever idea comes in is more radical. I mean, sometimes even I don't recognize if what I'm saying, given the years of experience I have in this country in terms of following and watching politics. I think that is the number one problem. It's not about democratization of the political parties, because even if you look into the field, the Dashnaks have their structure for 100 years. Republicans did do a good job in terms of bringing in a vibrant team, having their political school and everything. Even Lusavur Hayastan is doing the best they can in terms of structuring their party. And what comes to the Nikol Pashinyan civil contract, where I am partly guilty as well, there is no independent thinking in the party. And this I can say with all due, you know, like all responsibility. The same reflects in the parliament nowadays. So yeah, I think if Armenia wants to go forward and find a leader to do that, it's not going to be very hard. The difficult part is actually to work with the Armenian public and detox the Armenian public from whatever it was receiving for the past 2-3 years, because that was being very intensive poisoning of minds of people. And this is something that we are facing literally every day. Like just even following the recent arrests of the opposition members, Anjela Elibegova being held in the custody or being taken to the national security and some fake Facebook pages already calling and naming her an Azeri agent. So, and it's like they take one person, they make this person dirty, and that's it. It takes years to clean it, you know, and take it out of the public mind.
Defamation
so
right there.
That's, yeah, but it's they're using it to protect themselves from their own actions or the backlash to their actions, which is...
And it goes both ways, you have to say. It goes both ways. Also,
I agree with
people
you,
associated with the government.
I agree with you. It goes both ways, but the rule is set by Pashinyan himself. I'm sorry, I know him too well. His methods are literally very visible. And these are the methods that have been there since 2007, at least the time I remember, as a young person also supporting LTP movement. But like, all this is really the rules that is set by them. you know, the fake information or half true information, or naming people, shaming them, touching their families, literally making it so disgusting that you do think that politics is the most disgusting thing in this country, whereas politics itself is not that dirty. I mean, let's agree, yeah. So I don't know.
Well,
it could go both ways, but they're responsible more for me.
One other thing I wanted to mention, if we're still on the subject of the interview, it seemed to me that one big target for this interview was Robert Kocharyan, in the sense that Serge Sargsyan was trying to justify himself to Robert Kocharyan. I heard this line that the writer Levon Javakhyan shared in an interview shortly after the change of government in 2018, that apparently Kocharyan, after the change of government, told Serge Sargsyan, you know, I built this country brick by brick, and you're just breaking it apart. It seems to me that, you know, it might have been an actual line shared. I don't know if it's true or not, but Levon Javakhyan seems to have this sort of the sources. And one other thing to keep in mind is that Robert Kocharyan is actually the only politician in Armenia's history who left office out of his own will and actually passed the power over to his successor. So there is that precedent.
That was definitely a succession.
But
yes,
it hasn't been repeated since then.
Alan, did you have something?
Yes. I want to go back to the Artsakh negotiations. So Serge Sargsyan did talk about all the different agreements or documents that were on the table. He specifically said that he's not a Vochmi Tizakan, you know, not an inch of land. And he also said maximalism is to our detriment. And, you know, he talked about the 5+2 agreement. He went into some detail about that. And then there was a little bit of backlash to that. For instance, Ruben Rubinyan, he's a Maista parliamentarian. He came back and he simplified everything. And he said something like, are you accusing us of giving lands away or not giving lands away? Why are you calling us traitors, essentially? Another response was Edmond Marukyan, who said something like, why were you investing into parts of Artsakh that you were subject to negotiations that you may have given up as a result of negotiations? I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about this part of the conversation and some of the responses from Serge Sargsyan's opposition.
Well, I would love to comment on Rubinyan, you know, that given our common past what can I say to sound nice in this case? Because my family has lived in these territories for like 22 years. And even living there, we always understood that these territories are for negotiation. And to say that, why were you investing in there, is like the most amateur thing to be said by a politician who is, in any case, in any way, is trying to actually defend the interest of his own country and nation. So for me, it's really it's a theater of absurd for me to watch and see how they react to the Serge Sargsyan's interview. And the same with Arai Karutsunyan, who also tried to do the same thing with Garen Karapetyan case in this case. What can I say? It's nonsense. It is absolute nonsense, because I think that Serge Sargsyan is being absolutely honest. And the fact that he was called not an inch of land person is a branded label from the Levon Agans, from the first president supporters. And this way they were justifying, or at least drawing the fine line between their parties, which is they calling a peace party and the Republicans a war party. They need to make this image of Serge Sargsyan in order to actually make their stances more clear for public. However, after this war and after this situation and after the way the conflict was settled, as they believe so, it is really immoral to bring such arguments. And I believe that Serge Sargsyan is being honest when he says he's not Vochmi Tizakan, because he's actually probably one of the leaders of this country who has been quite open and not been afraid talking about 800 acres of land being lost during the 2016 war, and also being ready to talk about exchange of lands for substantial gain in the negotiations. Rubinyan is just being an amateur kid at this point.
Well, there's so much to talk about this issue, but I think I'm going to move on, because I also have my frustrations on that very topic, Marine. Okay. This past week, a bill was circulated by the Office of the Prosecutor General that criminalizes defamation through mass media or other public channels, and it imposes heavy fines and up to 2 years of imprisonment. In 2010, in a move commended by the Council of Europe, Serge Sargsyan's government decriminalized all forms of defamation in Armenia. Aspet Kochigyan, if 2010 could be regarded as a step toward freer speech and democratization in Armenia, could this bill be seen as a step backward?
The short answer is absolutely yes. However, I've been following the various manifestations of the proposal that has been put forward. And actually, there, if I'm not mistaken, I know for sure there were two, and I think there's a third one which is circulating about a proposed law to change the defamation and insults and so on. I think one of them is about increasing six times the amount of fine for an insult and defamation. And the other one is a more tougher law, which can also include up to 2 years of prison. Now, the question is, A, 2010 and 2021 are not the same thing. And I'm not just talking about the war, post-war period, but I'm also talking about the state of the media, the media landscape, if you want to call it, in the world and in Armenia as well. Discussions about this were actually circulating even before the war, and to a large extent, the concern about news and information, if you want to call it, or misinformation sometimes, that have been circulating on social media. And there were discussions about this. But obviously, since the war and the increased social media activism by both the government, pro-government and anti-government sources, has led to this new proposals being in place, which is quite concerning, because even though there have been attempts to define what do they mean, like in the law, in the first or the second proposed bill, there is an issue about unknown sources. Basically, they had to even clarify that. What do you mean by an unknown source? Is it like a secret source or a source on a website or a fake sort of a Facebook account and so on and so forth?
Yeah,
regardless of that, however, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, even if there is a good intention here in terms of stopping disinformation, the spread of disinformation, especially through social media. It's so open to, so very widely open to interpretation in different ways to address issue of any insult. Anything can be included as an insult. And it's not just at the top level, right? It's also about local government. There is a reference, I think, in the second proposed law about any defamation or insult against individuals who are in the local government. So in a way, it can be easily considered to be a gag law, but I'm not sure how it's going to develop, how it's going to be implemented and enforced. In the past, judges in Armenia have been very careful not to give the maximum fine, because at some point, one of the fines is that first bill that passed, it's up to 10 million dirhams, that's about $20,000, up to, you know, that's also a legalese term. So a judge might say, you know what,
that's,
you know,
that,
yeah,
fine.
I can see that this is an insult, but I will give, you know, I don't know, 5,000 dirhams, hypothetically. So there's also that implementation component there.
Marine, last week the government passed a law regulating reliance on anonymous sources in the media. Who do you think is the principal target for this week's bill?
Anyone who is against Nikol. So this
so
is
as
going
simple
to be
as that,
used.
Huh?
It is as simple as that. It is going to be, you know, he knows how to fight against this type of people. So if back in the time there was any sort of measures in the place to actually, you know, take him to the court for whatever he was writing as a journalist, probably Armenia would be in a different place today. But again, Armenia was being a complimentary state, you know, playing nice to the world and giving birth to people like Nikol, who literally came to power, destroyed the country for that was being built for 30 years with the, you know, efforts of the entire nation. I sound cynical, but that's exactly what it is. So maybe in a year when you have new prisons for people that used bad words against this government, you will remember what I'm saying. For today, we see who are they going after. You know, all the fake news, they're literally running after anyone who is outspoken critic of this government. And that is how they're going to use it. And they're going to have manpower of the oligarchs who serve them. Technically, all the criticism that we had for the previous government is going to be real this time, and we're going to see it. He is trying to build a dictatorial state, but unfortunately, this country does not have the resources for that, and he probably doesn't know it himself. Soon he will discover it, and we'll see how it will go from there.
Emil, do you expect a potential blowback from the international community on this?
The international community has changed in the past number of years. It's no longer Trump presidency in U.S., but, you know, it's a very distant outlook as far as the things happening in Armenia. I haven't seen any interest in Armenia, even in terms of sort of staying as an independent state as far as U.S. and West. So whatever happens in Armenia, you know, turns into a Khanate or to some kind of a oblast of Russia. I don't think U.S. fundamentally cares. And there might be some reports and some comments here and there, but I don't think it's going to be a significant issue.
I agree with Emil. There is going to be no reaction so whatsoever because the job is done. Like for them, the job is done. The civil society believes that they came to, they brought change to this country, and they continue, you know, sitting in these fancy rooms and going into philosophy of development of societies of this and that without actually realizing what happened to us. And they're like, they're going to continue doing it because all the whistleblowers are pocket whistleblowers and they are doing nowadays the job of the watchdogs for this government. So they're not actually doing the job that the civil society, any civil society should do, but rather using the sources that they receive from West to control or to continue being opposition to the previous government. So yeah, so we will not going to see any big clashes. Maybe there will be like some 2 points down in the charts of the freedom of speech and expression, Human Rights Watch and here and there, but that's going to be only like on the reports and nobody's going to make big news out of it. Because again, the whistleblowers are now have different agenda in the place.
I have to say, this is not driven by the change in Armenia was something that U.S. wanted to see, or a change in Armenia is something that U.S. even welcomed all that much. You know, there is not really
maybe not U.S. but other powers.
I mean, even the European Union. There is not much support for Nikol Pashinyan anywhere. It's just the focus has shifted in the United States, in the European Union, inwardly, and concerns about Russian power, concerns about Chinese power dominate over any kind of democratic shortcomings and things that might be happening. So even with like Belarus, they're trying to normalize relations to use that as a leverage against Russia. So I don't think it has anything to do with the domestic Armenian issues. It's just not important from US or European perspective.
Oh, no, no, that, I didn't mean domestically. I meant Nagorno-Karabakh issue is solved for everyone. And that was the only issue that they gave.
They gave lip service to it. Yes. They gave lip service to it. And again, they didn't care which way it would go. It was going to stay that way or to change again. They didn't care.
As long as the roads open and the oil flows.
Even
safely.
That, they don't really care about that. They, you know, the oil issues, gas issues, totally tertiary, you know, it's not an issue anymore. It used to be a defining aspect of U.S. policy in the 90s because there was a sense that money could be made and there was a sense that these areas could be made independent of Russia, etc. But now I don't think there's any optimism about any of that.
All right. During most of the past year, Armenia has been in a state of martial law. In Armenia, elections are not held in a state of emergency or martial law, so as a result, when the terms of various elected regional leaders have expired, their acting replacements have been appointed by the central government, the prime minister, or his political circle, without due elections. Marine, can you talk a little bit about the short and the long-term repercussions of these appointments and delayed elections?
The fact that they're not holding early elections, I believe it's because of the reports coming in about the rating of Pashinyan going down very big. I know that internally they are changing the election law and they will be holding certain elections sooner or later. And I know that the electoral codes are being tailored the way they want to be tailored.
Yeah.
And pretty much the internal information coming in is that it is going to be falsified. No matter, like they're going to use the entire service of the falsification machine as much as they can. So this is what I'm getting from the parliament.
We've actually talked about those electoral reforms that they're trying to do and whether it's appropriate to do it now or what the timing is all about.
Well, the timing is, number one, is that Pashinyan did chicken out in a way, because when Robert Kochan made the announcement that they are going to participate in the elections and they're going to win, right after this, Pashinyan technically came out and said there's going to be no elections. So I believe that he was afraid, and this is very personal with him because he is really very afraid of Robert Kocharyan. That's like a pathological fear he has. Longer Pashinyan stays in power, worse it's going to get. So how and what ways is going to continue ruling, I have a hard time analyzing it because it will be just speculating. Elections will come sooner or later, maybe a year or two. I cannot predict anything because it's really very fuzzy picture.
Asped, your thoughts?
I have to say that the issue of the electoral reform has been on the forefront of the current factions and the current ruling factions and the government's agenda since day one, even before the 2018 December elections. So from that perspective, The question is not about electoral reform or electoral law amendments. Rather, as Marina mentioned, it's about when to hold the elections. Now, that being said, it is still unclear for me. I have read the proposed legal change.
To the electoral and reform? There are,
Not the electoral reform, but the about the appointment of interim leaders, municipal leaders or local council leaders and so on and so forth. On the one hand, they talk about Article 27, which is already in place in the Constitution, especially point 2.1, where they actually look at that in the event that there are no elections because of, you know, martial law, the prime minister appoints the interim leader of municipal councils and the marzbet, the governors, appoint the interim leaders of the village councils. Regardless of the issue of what Marina mentioned, that this is also a way to consolidate, to develop administrative resources for down the line in the election. The proposed law itself has some contradiction because it does talk about the local government election or the laws on local government, especially, interestingly, juxtaposed number 72, Article 72, where it says that in the event that there are no elections, the elections do not take place for whatever reason, then the existing council and the municipal leaders and the municipal councils and the village councils would continue, extend their tenure until a new election takes place. The reason why I'm talking about this, it's quite interesting and sometimes schizophrenic to see the laws, to emphasize the law rather than introduce the new law, and also the reaction to it. From what I've been seeing is that they're just announcing or reconfirming that there's this law and we're going to follow this. But the interpretation sometimes is that, oh, this is a new law that they're trying to implement to increase the government, the centralized control. And don't forget, Armenia does have a centralized control. As much as in the last 10 years or so, there have been a lot of effort by international community to train and help to develop local decentralized government. But at the end of the day, the marzbet, the governors of the regions in Armenia, are all appointed by the central authority, in this case, the prime minister. So that is also something to be considered in that context, which goes back to also the issue of whether or not martial law should be lifted, will be lifted or should be lifted.
Emil, what do you think about the fact that martial law is still in place in Armenia? Is there any good reason to not lift it?
Objectively, there isn't. There is no reason to keep it in place, but of course it's additional layer of protection for Nikol Pashinyan not to be voted out of power. It's sort of a tripwire. If there is a majority to lift it without his consent, that means that there is also a majority to remove him without his consent. It's sort of a paranoid fear of resigning to trigger the election that was discussed, that, you know, they wanted to do a constitutional change just to make sure that nobody else is nominated. It tells me that there is a lot of fear on the part of the prime minister that even with his own team can sort of rebel against him. And there was some discussion of Lilit Makun's appointment to be ambassador. And I thought about it in two ways. One way is, of course, having political appointees rather than diplomatic appointees abroad representing this government. But on the other hand, it seems to me Lilit Makuns is one of the few people who could actually lead the rebellion against Nikol Pashinyan in parliament. And this, you know, removing her from there, I think, is another sort of sign of his paranoia that he doesn't want anybody who has any sort of distinct voice potentially threatening him.
Okay. The Homeland Salvation Movement held a mass demonstration in Freedom Square on February 20th calling for the resignation of Nikol Pashinyan. It's worth noting that the weather was not very favorable for an outdoor gathering with heavy snowfall and temperatures near freezing. Estimates of the crowd size ranged from 20,000 to 40,000 people. The participants included some of the major players, Dashnak Tsun, Hanra Petakans, Bargavac, Artur Vanatsyan's Hayrenik, and a number of smaller political parties and public figures. Maine, this was the first large demonstration in 2 months. The movement has also announced the next rally on Monday. Do you think the opposition will be able to build momentum and exert sufficient pressure from the street to force Pashinyan to resign?
To be honest, I'm pretty skeptical about it. I am following closely and I am looking into the also the moods that are swinging. I think they just started and they do have a chance to build a momentum. However, I don't expect to have something like it was in 2018 to remove Pashinyan from power. I am truly hoping that they will be able to remove him. And to be very, very and absolutely honest with you, I do not care whether it's going to be constitutional way or unconstitutional way, because we are in a state where this country will collapse even more so if this government continues. Because even if he would call an election and then he would be reelected, probably even then some moods would change rather than what we have now. It is a complete apathy, and it is like a very, probably this is our Great Depression in a way. So we are all very, very depressed when it comes to the future of this country. And I don't think that most of the people will choose to stay and fight, but rather to leave. So it's a turning point for this state. I am hoping that they will gain the momentum. However, I also have issues about having a clear agenda in the place, because removing kids is one thing, but then what's next is still being very open. Although I do understand that it is the most important fact to remove him and then look into the next part. And of course, for me personally, it's very important what is next for Nagorno-Karabakh, for Artsakh, because if the independence or if the return of the certain territories, at least the Lvim, you know, the Autonomous Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh is not restored, or there is no plan for that, I would be very skeptical about any power that does not speak of it openly.
When we talk about a momentum, right, what would it be different now? They already tried to do something a couple of months ago and it stalled. Everyone was saying, oh, they should get momentum, they should develop a momentum. But 2 months later, is it like they got a new engine to get a new momentum? Do they have a new thing? I mean, what are the chances that they did gather some people, you know, a couple of months ago, but then it stalled? Monday, they're going to go do it again. They're going to gather again, but then, you know, what would be different now that they would have a momentum?
I can guess that that momentum can be built through the economic situation being worse or getting worse, because we've been seeing that for the society is still in shock from the war, from what happened, from the number of losses we had, the fact that a lot of bodies are not still returned to their families and loved ones. So it is scattered for now. So maybe when the, let's say, when the situation changes towards spring and when the aftershock comes in a way, this could be something to be used as for building up the momentum. Also, knowing the people who are in the fight, I think there will be some processes that are going under the radar and that probably will bring some change or will help in terms of building a momentum.
Yeah, still, I'm not convinced that, you know, what you're talking about, the economic aftershock, is something that is long way due. And a momentum assumes that a continuity. So from now until that shock settles in and prepares a fertile ground for them to build upon, it's still a couple of months off. So what, another big mass gathering in 2 months to see that if it started? It's like trying to start a fire and like you're trying to do the first time it didn't work, the second time it didn't work. The third time, maybe the leaves would be dry, the wind would be in the right place, and so on. I think it's at least from what I'm seeing from outside of that movement, is that it's like, okay, let's try again to see if, you know, more people would come in. It's sort of like quite, I wouldn't call it disorganized, but quite lack of path, pathless.
I
would cut some slack for the protesters, because there's been like a long year's establishment of the country. So they are lacking some techniques and skills. However, I would not forget the days when Pashinyan started walking from Gyumri, and by the 10th day, his movement was dying too. And then all of a sudden, the momentum was built. I would give them some time and probably wish for good, hope that they will manage to do it. I understand what you're saying. I also have the same skepticism. But to be honest, if I don't have this hope, then I will be absolutely destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have some hope. And there is a history of the protest movements in the country where most of these protests went in cycles. But I mean, that doesn't mean that, they should stop or that they shouldn't happen and that people should lose hope. I mean, it's a current moment is very, very dire. This particular protest, I thought, was definitely not embarrassing in any way. It was a good turnout. Of course, the mood is still quite mournful and somber rather than angry and sort of action oriented. But, you know, those things tend to change and people tend to regroup and continue pushing. What is important to keep in mind, of course, is that it will take cooperation from Nikol Pashinyan to achieve any kind of peaceful transition of power. If he doesn't want to give up power then and manages to keep his majority under control in parliament, then it won't happen. It's just as simple as that. You need to have somebody like Serge Sargsyan to be ready to really release power, just not be in the mood to use force. And I'm not sure Nikol Pashinyan is in that mood. I think he would be willing to use force to keep power, and the crackdowns will have an effect on the attrition of the protest movement, etc. But again, what's the alternative? Not to have the protest movement? I mean, I don't think that's a legitimate alternative.
Emil, I wanted to follow up and actually ask a question related to what something Marina said about the agenda of this these protests. So one thing that Vazgen Manukyan said during the rally is that we can't immediately make changes to most of the November 9th agreement. But one of the points that needs to be addressed right away is the road through Sunik. And he said that no other country should be allowed to monitor that road, and it should be exclusively under the supervision of Armenia. So it seemed like this was a concrete proposal that he was making. What do you think about this statement, or in general, what can be done about the November 9th agreement after change of power?
You know, I think there is overemphasis over this road issue. In general, this whole discussion of roads, and it's like, you know, people look at Armenia as this physical body that, you know, might be invaded by, you know, foreign transportation or something like that. I don't see a problem with Azerbaijanis using that road at all. As long as there is some quid pro quo, the airport in Stepanakert starts to function and can connect between Stepanakert and Yerevan, make it easier for people to travel around. If they're using a road through Karabakh, the Armenians should be able to use the road through Kelbajar, through Karabajar. In terms of monitoring, again, right now, Sunik is basically defended by the Russian forces, and the Iranian border is also covered by the Russian forces. So if Russian forces also monitor traffic on the Mehri road, I don't see that as a big problem. I think it's much more of a manipulative argument that, oh, they're giving up Armenian territory. Yeah, they gave up a lot of Armenian territory already. I don't think there is any doubt about that. But in terms of access and the use of the roads, I think there shouldn't be a big stumbling block. As long as there is quid pro quo and Armenians can use the roads they want to use, they need to use, and routes that they need to use.
And I don't think that there is any question for the sovereignty either. I think recently Anna Nardalian made a statement that there was never a promise to give up any kind of territory, just the opening of communications over the road, that's all.
Just a small comment regarding the road issues. I think the problem is not that people don't want communications to open up or trade start or be good neighbors whatsoever, but right after such a bloody war and then a lot of unfair situations, there is a feeling of army being dismantled and having actually no defense and no army. This is the main issue, I believe. And because there is the lack of communication from leadership, there is technically feeling of having no leadership. So I think this is what makes people more concerned about the overall situation in Sunik. And it is quite intimidating to actually go through from Yerevan to Kapan and have to pass through the Azeri checkpoints in the country where you would just drive freely and see no foreign forces around you, wherever you would go. So I think this is more of a issue like that and the overall situation we ended up being in.
Did you make a trip down there?
Yes, my parents did. I'm still collecting my, you know, inner forces to go to Karabakh and also go to Sunik. In a month or so, I will definitely make these two trips down to both places. Of course, I would love to go through Kelbajar, but I guess I have to postpone it for some time.
Marine, would you be willing to talk about Kovsakan a little bit, sort of the last days there?
Well, on the 9th of October, I was getting information that the terrorist groups are coming with the pickups and stuff towards the Arax border checkpoints. I talked to Artur Hovhannisyan, and he tells me, and I have the record on the voice, he says they will never get to Kovsakan, Marjan, like never ever in their life. So that was like 9th of October, and then on the 18th, 17th, the population was out. My father was back there just to take the passports and documents, and if it wasn't me, they would also be captive as hostages or even be killed, because literally, like, he drove out of the city while they were shooting at them from distance. So, and it was no military forces there. There were no units in the place to actually defend. So the entire borderline was defenseless. So these people just literally took a walk from Ishkhan Azor Kubatli area down to Kovsakan. And the Armenian armed forces just positioned themselves a little bit outskirts of Bikapan.
It's amazing how this situation was just a reversal of 1993, just like the mirror opposite.
Exactly.
Same thing happened in 1993.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but what was the reason, you think, because the army was destroyed in Jabrail, the army units that went to Jabrail, they were...
Overall, we had 14 kilometers of breakthrough. I mean, the breaking of the lines of the defense line out of 200... 48 kilometers, if 52 maybe, I don't remember correct. First of all, Movsesen Sakopian gave explanation of that, and when I look into the information I was getting in, I could say that it is what it was. The changing of the protocols, and also people from Zangil and Kovsakan fighting in that area, their testimonies were really very scary. And also later on, when the videos came in of the army units running away from that area, and because of the no command point around them, no generals, nobody taking decisions. So the army was left without command. But yeah, it was the south that broke. And Serge Sargsyan was right when he said, why didn't he shoot with this gun there down there to the most gathered area of Azeri forces? So
yeah, the Iskander thing is basically, it's an accurate weapon, but to be able to bring it to where you want it to bring, you have to have eyes over that target to make sure that it's still the target, so that people hadn't evacuated from there or they're still concentrating there. So I think the entire war, they had trouble getting accurate intelligence, on-time intelligence, and, you know, to be able to say, just use it to shoot it at a target.
Of course they did. Yeah. For 3 years, the Russian intelligence did not share anything with Armenia. Right. I mean, for 3 years, this is like being blind.
What was the population in that area, Kovsakan, in that area? How many people were there?
Well, entire, let's say, I don't know the exact number, but I know that entire Kashatakh had around 10,000 people. It's nobody had any illusions, like looking at how deprived the area is. You know, we knew, all of us knew that this is negotiable. But nobody knew that it's going to be just given away with nothing in return, you know? I mean, but that area fed 60% of Armenia with bread
really?
And
what
a lot.
What area? You mean the south?
Other stuff. Yeah, the south of Dakhtumaz. I don't know how to, I mean, Dakhtumaz, Kovsakan area. Yeah, that all, till Jebrail, you know, like getting to the Jebrail, that's already like more of a non-harvesting situation there. But all that area in the south, it had a lot of, like, the best lands ever. We had about 2 acres of already ready olive trees coming up. So everything was growing there, technically.
All right. I guess this is a good place to break off for today. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Aspet. Thank you, Marine. Thank you, Emil and Alan.
Bye-bye, Aspet. Thank you.
Bye. Take care.
That concludes our program for this Week in Review episode. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and your suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at grung.org or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. On behalf of everyone in this episode, we wish you a good week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels, like our pages, and follow us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.